I'm Ryan.
And I'm Andy.
And this
is
Shivers. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Ryan.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. You know.
Thanks for walking me through all my tech issues.
It's all right. It's amazing to me, like, when I think about, like, oh, when we did it at the library, like, all that stuff was already set up, and we didn't have to deal with this, and we didn't have to deal with the remote stuff, but, like, it still took us 20 minutes to get set up at the library.
It did.
Yeah, so it did. At least.
But it was still more convenient, I think, than this.
Yeah, maybe.
At least for me, because I'm just sometimes technologically challenged.
Well, I don't think that you spend as much time on the computer as I do. So
I'm not on it a lot aside from work, really.
Yeah. I am definitely on the computer more now than I was before. But like my husband is definitely like a gamer. My son is a gamer. And so like we end up being just like a gaming household. So not only am I on the computer for the podcast, so I have like a decent mic and I have like my mic arm and stuff. But like, I also have all kinds of like fancy game computer stuff. Like I have like two monitors and like a glowy, like my mouse has like lighting on it and my keyboard also has lighting on it. Oh, but don't be fooled. I actually have two keyboards.
They're pretty though with all those lights on them.
I like them. I don't know the first thing about computer gaming. Nothing. I know nothing.
Well, I picked this mouse because it feels good in my hand, and this keyboard is a hand-me-down, and I have it out because it's really quiet, so I can type while we're recording, because the keyboard that I picked to buy is very clickety-clackety, and I love it. It makes me feel like I'm typing really fast. See, look. Wow. But yeah, so I just plugged in the old one because it's quiet and I can type while we're recording.
There you go.
Disruptive. So yeah. How have you been?
I've been good. Good. I started a new job in January, so that's been good. It's been a big learning curve, but it's been good, and I'm enjoying it. So far, so good.
Good.
Haven't really done anything else.
Well, I mean, it's still kind of locked down here in Ohio.
Yeah, but cases are declining, so that's good. I think our lives might get a sliver of normalcy soon here, I hope.
I'm hoping.
Yeah.
It's been a rough year.
Yeah. Yes.
Goodness. Have you watched or done anything spooky since the last time we recorded?
No, nothing spooky. I'm seriously slacking on that, but I have started watching a couple, like thriller shows.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not spooky, nothing paranormal, but they're suspense thriller dramas and they've been really good. So that's really been occupying my time.
Good. Good. Yeah, I had kind of like hit a place where I didn't have like really any more horror stuff, like any full length stuff that I wanted to watch. I did watch the new docuseries about the Cecil Hotel and Alyssa Lamb.
I wanted to see that.
They did a really good job.
Yeah.
That's the one that's on Netflix.
I
mean, I already knew the story of her, but it was still, they did a very good job. I liked it. I would recommend.
Oh, good. I mean, I'm not, I know what happens to her. but I don't know all of the circumstances and how everything came to be the way it did. So that's why I'm interested in watching it to see how everything kind of came to be. But
They did a really good job.
Very sad. Very sad.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's been kind of about it for me. Nothing really new. I've been playing a lot of Phasmophobia, which is spooky, but you know, nothing new there.
Yeah.
So yeah. I wanted to apologize sort of to the listeners. We had to take a little break because I was dealing with the death of a pet, which was very hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I needed some time to kind of deal with that and find a new groove. I don't know if I talked about, so when my dog got sick in the fall, I was having a really hard time, and we got a cat. I don't know if I talked about the cat on the podcast.
I don't think so. I don't recall you saying anything.
So I got a kitten, an older kitten, and he's all white, and his name is Gus, and he's just like the funniest cat. He's hilarious, and he definitely has helped me out a lot. So
that's Gus.
Gus, he's great. We really lucked out because the shelters are all like, they're all doing, you know, COVID differently, and the shelter that we usually go to, we go to the APL.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you can't, like, people aren't allowed in there. The public can't go inside. So you like make an appointment and they bring the animal outside. And, you know, for cats, you can't really do a meet and greet outside. So we had called about a kitten that, like, and we, like, put in our application. And he got, like, adopted, like, right before, like, it was, like, right before our application. Like, somebody, like, two applications before us adopted him. So when they called, they were like, well, you know, like, what are you looking for in a kitten? Do you want us to check and see what we have? And I was like, you know, I want, you know, I would prefer a very young kitten because I want like a buddy. And, you know, in my experience, the younger we adopt them, the more like, kind of like the more you can mold their personalities, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was like, but I, you know, I really need a buddy. And she was like, all right, well, let me go see. And I told her like a couple cats that looked cute on the website, and she came back and she was like, so those kittens were very scared. But there was this other cat, and he's, you know, he's this old, and this is what he looks like. And I know he wasn't one you were interested in, but he came like right up and he was meowing and he wanted to get pet. And so that's the one that we got, and he's been awesome. So,
See, when it comes to pets joining the family, I feel like everything happens for a reason. You get the one that you're meant to get. Pets pick their people. They come to you.
Yeah. He sure did. So he's been quite the blessing for me going through this. So
good. Well, I'm glad.
Yeah. So, yeah. But now I'm ready to talk about some spooky stuff.
Yeah.
And we're covering a topic that we've been it's been kind of just getting like shuffled back for a while now.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think it's about time. We're finally going to be covering possessions and exorcisms.
Yes. And yay. I mean, there's so much information. Like we could probably spend like, I mean, an entire month probably talking about possession and exorcism. So we might even have to do a separate episode, like as a part two, or, you know, a to be continued, because there's so much here. And I, like, my notes just started to run away with me last night. I was like, what the hell? Like, I'm like, I know what I want to do, but I can't, like, I couldn't get myself narrow enough to get there. So
I was kind of in the same boat, and I told you like these are the movies I want to cover, but these are the movies I feel like I should cover. And like, I kept going back and forth. So, you know, I'm in the same boat. I did more movie stuff than I kind of wanted to, but I feel like these topics, we're going to have a lot of opportunities to talk about details about possessions and exorcisms, like, throughout the future of the show, just because so many topics, like specific historic context and like certain cases or specific movies, have so much to do with the topic. So we'll be able to keep coming back to it. So I feel like if the listeners are like upset because we didn't talk about like something about these topics that they feel like is important, like, you can send us an email and let us know, but we're probably going to end up covering it
eventually
in the future.
We can circle back.
And it's just, especially when you look at possessions, it's just so, it's like a foundation of like horror. Like, the whole idea of a possession. Like, even if you look at things outside of exorcisms, like the movie The Taking of Deborah Logan, it's often referred to as a possession film, but there's no exorcism, you know? So I really feel like these topics are going to keep coming up. So do not despair.
Yes.
So we'll consider this just like the 101.
Yeah. The very broad overview.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So let's do it.
Okay, cool. So the way I want to kind of start out is by talking about the belief in possession worldwide, because so many cultures have a belief in possession. When you talk about exorcism in particular, and I'm going to briefly touch on that probably in, I don't know, 20 minutes. I am speaking specifically to exorcism as it relates to Catholicism and the Catholic Church. There are some cultures and religions who, you know, they do subscribe to some kind of, you know, exorcist, like theorem or practice. There's exorcists in different, you know, religious groups. But I think, especially in the Western world, the US and Europe, as it relates to possession, when you think of exorcism, you think of the Roman Catholic Church and priests conducting those. So that's where I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. But throughout this research, I thought it was really interesting. There are rabbis in Judaism and the Jewish culture, mostly those who are very, you know, practiced in Kabbalah. They actually do exorcisms. In Japan, there's like a whole phenomenon around exorcising what they call like demon dogs from people that cause them to be sick. So while those are fascinating things, I'm not going to touch on them here. And if any listeners are interested in us covering those topics in particular, I can always circle back in the future. But for all intents and purposes here, let's kick it off with possession. Yes. So do the damn thing. So possession is defined as the taking over of a body by a supernatural or paranormal entity or being. And the belief in possession has been around for thousands of years. It's acknowledged in a wide variety of cultures. In fact, I think there's more cultures in the world that do believe in possession than those that do not.
Interesting.
Yes. So I'm going to kind of get into it. So Erica Eichhorn Bourguignon was an American anthropologist who was one of the first people to study possession trance. In particular, a lot of her studies took place in the country of Haiti. Now, we know Haiti is a place where they practice voodoo, not necessarily voodoo. I think that's a bastardized way to say it. It's the correct pronunciation is voodoo. It stems from the West African religion of Vodun, seen in countries like Benin on the Western African coast. But so this is a place particularly where Erica focused a lot of her work. In 1969, she led a study that was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. And she ended up finding that the belief in spirit possession exists in 74% of a sample of 488 societies across the globe. Wow. So, yeah, that is, let's just call it three quarters of the world, or, you know, out of 488 societies that believe in possession of some sort. Not necessarily, I mean, demonic possession, if you can go so far as to say demonic is, you know, not just demons, but also evil spirits, evil forces, things like that. This is what these cultures believe. I thought this was interesting. So the highest amount of belief comes from Pacific cultures. And the lowest incidence of belief comes from Native American cultures in both North and South America.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was really interesting. I mean, again, this was done in 1969. So, I mean, maybe things have shifted since then. I don't know. But 1969 is still relatively recent. I mean, you know, there's people who were born back then that are still alive today. You know, it's not hundreds of years ago. But in particular, I wanted to touch on the fact that, you know, Erica studied in Haiti. Haitian voodoo is rife with spirit possession. And that comes as no surprise because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it stems from the West African religious beliefs of Vodun. And then it also mixes in elements of Christianity. And a lot of it comes from Roman Catholicism because of the slave trade. You know, whiteys establishing, you know, colonies in the Bahamas, they brought elements of Catholicism and Christianity with them. And we know that possession and exorcism have a long history in the Catholic Church. So Haitian voodoo, it kind of brings together Christianity and this West African religion of Vodun. In voodoo, the person being possessed often invites deities or spirits known as loa to possess them. And this is seen as a method of communication between people and the deities or the loa. So this is a way to kind of commune with those that you worship, which is super interesting to me because, as we know it, possession is seen very differently in other countries around the world, especially Christian countries or any country with Abrahamic beliefs, Islam and Judaism included. Basically, in those other countries, possession is a bad thing. You get possessed by evil forces. Mm-hmm. Whereas in voodoo and in Vodun as well, you're possessed by the gods or deities, and they are coming to you to give you messages. They're coming to you to communicate either with you directly or with your subgroup of people. This happens through, you know, trance dances. So it's actually a time of kind of celebration. People are doing this to kind of celebrate the gods, receive these messages. These other religions are not doing that, especially those found in Europe and Middle East, as I mentioned, the Abrahamic religions. The belief in possession is obviously not new because it dates back thousands of years. And this kind of blew me away. So the farthest back that we can safely say that there have been instances of possession being, you know, talked about, discussed, recorded, is back to ancient Mesopotamia. Now, time for a history lesson. Ryan, do you know when Mesopotamia was kind of like founded, when Mesopotamia came to be as a civilization?
I don't know, maybe like 1000 BCE.
Even before that, but you're close. So ancient Mesopotamia was settled as early as 14,000 BCE.
Okay.
But became a true civilization around 4000 BCE, with the first written language occurring in 3000 BCE. So a hell of a long time ago.
Yeah.
But the ancient Mesopotamians believed that all forms of sickness came from spirits entering a person's body and causing them harm.
Okay.
The kingdom of Assyria, which was also located in Mesopotamia, they also referenced the use of incantations and prayers to the gods, as well as, you know, direct challenges in their chants or, you know, kind of not necessarily prayers, but their communication with demons. And these things were believed to inflict physical and psychological disease on humans, the demons that they were communicating with to drive them out. The Assyrians also believed that they inflicted physical and psychological disease, just like the Mesopotamians did, or the ancient Mesopotamians. Mm-hmm. Babylonian priests were also said to have performed rituals to expel or exorcise demons by destroying a clay or wax figure of them. So they would create almost kind of like, a figurine that they could destruct, and it would essentially then, kind of like magical thinking, it would take away that aspect of the possession. So it would drive it out of the person, mm-hmm. or the place. Could be a place that was, possessed as well.
Right.
In the ancient Vedas of Hinduism, which were composed around 1000 BCE, so you're not too far off in your timeline of thinking when things date back, there were evil beings that were noted which interfere with the work of the gods and cause harm to the living. Also around 600 BCE, there are accounts from ancient Persia showing evidence of demon and spirit expulsion through the use of prayer, ritual, and holy water used by the religious leader Zoroaster. So he created essentially Zoroastrianism, which is mm-hmm. completely different topic for another day. In Jewish folklore, now this is something that I would actually love to do a follow-up episode on, because this one we could do all by itself. In Jewish folklore, most notably that found in the Kabbalah, an evil spirit called a dybbuk had the ability to possess a person and cause them harm. So a dybbuk is essentially a very evil, malevolent spirit seen as a demon that really attaches itself to the person, changes their behavior, changes their status of their health, mm-hmm. things like that. And there are, specific ways to drive them out. And the folklore around the dybbuk is so interesting. So as a side note, I kind of want to do an episode on that.
Oh yeah. I feel like it may have been on like the original episode topic idea list. And yeah. When I was planning which movies to watch for this episode, there were a couple that I was like, oh no, that'll go with like a dybbuk episode. So
we'll definitely
be covering it in the future.
Awesome, because that was fascinating. I had never really heard about it, learned about it before really kind of starting to research this stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's something that stood out to me. As I mentioned, there are rabbis who perform exorcisms, but they must have mastered practical Kabbalah in order to do so. So there is a little bit of, I guess, a process mm-hmm. for them to do it. In the Western world, aka Christian Europe, ancient superstition and demonology saw a revival during the Middle Ages, which is the time frame from roughly 500 CE to roughly 1500 CE. So the Middle Ages, scholars go back and forth on when that ended, but typically they go with roughly around 1453 CE, because that was the fall of Constantinople, which... Okay. kind of demarcated the end of the Christian reign kind of in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. We also see a lot of demonology and superstition possession going on during the early Renaissance period, which kind of coincides a little bit with the Middle Ages. So 1300 to 1600 CE. But in all of the cases that we see for demon possession, spirit possession, the common denominators, regardless of culture, are speaking in a voice that is not your own, speaking in tongues or in an unfamiliar language, a language that you do not know normally, that you've never been trained in, had exposure to, but you're fluent in it somehow, some way. Bodily spasms, contortions, or convulsions, superhuman strength, yelling of random insults, could be blasphemies, could be profanities, and also severe lethargy or hyperactivity. Hmm. But you know what these all sound like to me? These all sound like they could be symptoms of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
During the Middle Ages and the Renaissance period, those who likely had mental illness were regarded as being possessed. And to treat them, they were put through barbaric things. In order to drive the evil forces out of them, you know, they were subjected to things like scourging, which was whipping, mm-hmm. Methods of extreme starvation, induced vomiting, induced urination, and also bloodletting, which... let's cut you open and make you bleed to make you better, which that stems back to like ancient Greece. And that is just so like fascinating line of thought to me, because it goes back to like the four humors. You know, you've got yellow bile, black bile, whatever other, you know, things. I can't remember the other two humors, but like cutting you open to bleed out those things and get the evil out is what these people were put through. But a lot of these symptoms sound like they could actually be symptoms of bipolar, dissociative identity disorder, possibly even Tourette syndrome, mm-hmm. schizophrenia, epilepsy, you know, just to name a few mental illnesses that we are aware of that we know exist today. But, you know, maybe some people weren't affected by mental illness. So how do we explain that kind of phenomena? So this is a question I want to pose to you. So I say, you know, sure, it could be a paranormal, you know, situation or where we are dealing with a spirit. But what if it was psychosomatic? So if perception is reality, and during these times, people were very hypersensitive to suggestibility. I mean, just look, it launched us into the Salem witch trials in 1692. So if people actually believed or were made to believe that they were possessed, would they display their beliefs and their behaviors? What do you think?
I mean, I think that certainly could account for like a certain amount of like mm-hmm. cases of possession. There are like definitely cases of you know, like mass hysteria, where it seems like at least some of those people have to have been like convinced, right?
Yeah,
that there was something wrong with them. But I mean, I don't think that accounts for every case by any stretch, but I think that, you know, it's definitely a factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's important to know that I think back then it was overdiagnosed as possession. Mm-hmm. Do I believe in the existence of these things, malevolent spirits, whatever they may be? Sure. Do I necessarily think they're demons? No, but they could be pissed off spirits, like an Onryo. We know Onryos could possess people and places. So if they're vengeful spirits, maybe even a poltergeist or something that just wants to mess around, fuck around and find out. But I think back then it was definitely, you know, overdiagnosed as, oh, spirit possession. So these are the things we need to do. But I came across an article that was written in 2016 by a psychiatrist. And we can link it in the show notes if you want. It didn't really give a whole lot away, aside from this psychiatrist just saying, yes, I'm a board-trained clinician and I help exorcists, formal Catholic priests who perform exorcisms in 2016, in the 21st century. He helps them distinguish between if a client or a patient is expressing, you know, or presenting with these symptoms, whether it's paranormal mm-hmm. or if it's, you know, psychological, mental illness.
Right.
And I think that collaboration is really interesting. So it was kind of a cool article to see. I didn't know that that was a thing. I didn't know that they were, the Catholic Church was consulting psychologists or psychiatrists to help them identify should they do an exorcism or not. I think that's amazing, because we know back then mental illness was just regarded as being possessed.
Right.
And speaking of you know, the Catholic Church being involved and doing exorcisms. It's kind of a nice segue into my next segment to kind of give a few facts, recent facts about exorcism in the Catholic Church. So as recent as 2018, 250 priests from 50 countries attended a week-long exorcism course hosted by the Vatican. And this is an annual course.
Wow.
Yeah. So like these days, this is still going on. They're still teaching people about it. They're still conducting these classes and putting priests through the process to become trained right. to perform exorcism rites. According to the Catholic Church's catechism, a major exorcism can only be carried out by a priest with a bishop's approval. So essentially, you have to kind of go through the Vatican to get approval to do this. So that can take a good amount of time. Mm-hmm. The rite of exorcism involves specific prayers and an invocation to leave the host's body in the name of Jesus Christ, whom, you know, they identify as the demon essentially submitting their power to, because this has happened in the Bible. Christ performed exorcisms himself, drove demons and evil spirits out by essentially exerting his authority over them, and eventually they submitted. In Italy alone, 500,000 people reportedly seek exorcisms annually. 500,000. See, this is why that is so many, especially these days. This is why I'm like, we really have to delineate and be very careful when it comes to
Italy.
Yeah,
that's so many people.
Yeah. Well, I think it's people around the world traveling to or writing the Vatican to seek approval. 500,000, but still 500,000 annually saying, "Hey, I need an exorcism." That I still think that's a large number.
Oh yeah.
But here this made me raise my eyebrows. In 1999, the Catholic Church made its first major update to the rules surrounding exorcism since 1614. And finally distinguished between demonic possession and physical or psychological illness. It took them that long, over 300 years, to say, hey, yeah, mental illness might actually play a factor in this. So as a result, kind of alluding to the article that I mentioned earlier, exorcists will now usually work with a client's physician, psychologist, or psychiatrist to first rule out mental or physical illness before diagnosing and treating someone for demonic possession. Mm-hmm. And that's all I've got.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
So, so then that leads us into why do we have so many like movies about exorcisms and possessions? Like what is about this topic that has people so interested? And if you are like, well, you know, they're not super popular movies, are they? No, they are. There was, like from like the early aughts to 2012-ish, there was an exorcism or possession themed film every year.
Yeah, I could see that. So that's over roughly 12 that came out each year.
Well, one every year for like 12 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were very popular, obviously, for different studios to keep doing them. This trend, well, it wasn't 12 years because the trend started with The Exorcist, The Beginning in 2004. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened that same year, The Passion of the Christ was released. And The Passion of the Christ earned $600 million.
Yeah, I believe it.
At the box office. So it like created this kind of environment where filmmakers were like, okay, well, you know, like, obviously people wanted to see, like, religious movies because this movie was wildly successful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain extent, Christian people were like, you know, how can we make more Christian movies?
yeah.
Because if you think about it, the, like, by far the majority of exorcism movies tend to shed a positive light on the church.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So we end up with, like, this weird kind of film situation where people, you know, you go to a horror movie on Friday night and then it kind of compels you to go to church on Sunday.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, it definitely is one of those interesting things where you have to see that, like, it incorporates different kinds of people, you know, and mm-hmm. there are people who may be willing to go see a movie about an exorcism, that would be totally against seeing a movie about, like, a ghost, right? Because that, like, in the Christian faith, like, a disembodied spirit is not something that's going to happen, right?
Yeah. Because yeah.
In the afterlife, you go to a place. You don't just hang around.
Unless you're in purgatory.
Unless. But
yeah,
you don't
but you don't float around, like, earth. Right. That's not part of their belief. Yeah. I know. I got what you're saying.
So... So one of the other things why we like possession movies is that it can be, like, a metaphor for other things going on. So it can be a metaphor for addiction or other habits that control us and threaten to destroy the good things in our lives. So it is, like, an allegory for, like, overcoming, like, your own darkness and, like, getting to move along with life without those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, you know, the like classic good versus evil dichotomy. But this is super interesting to me. This guy, Dr. Tim Nelson, he was quoted in an article through the BBC that I'll link in the show notes. And he has an interesting take on it, which is, like, I feel like this is indisputable, that exorcism movies, to a certain extent, are metaphors for puberty.
What?
So... Wait.
I feel like I need to, like, digest this.
Okay.
Exorcism movies mm-hmm. are metaphors for puberty.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, coming of age, because you're wrestling with demons? Mm. Like,
oh no. Why though? So much more than that.
Why though? So... I mean, I didn't think puberty was that hard. Like, puberty's not life or death. What?
So, a overwhelming majority of exorcism movies deal with a teen or preteen that's being taken over by, like, strange forces or desires or drives. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Often the person who's so-called possessed, behaves or says things that are sexual in nature.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking about movies. We're not talking about real life, right? We're talking about movies about exorcism. And the parents seek help from an outside source because they don't recognize the way that their child is behaving as their child.
I mean, I think it's a stretch.
So, yeah, maybe, but you, I really agree with this guy that to an extent, like possession movies are movies about a bad influence corrupting an innocent child.
Yes. And I think that's a better way to put it than just be like, hey, these hormones during puberty are making your kid go do weird things. I think that it's weird to me to just pinpoint puberty. Mm-hmm. Like, I think you could use it as a metaphor or an allegory for a lot of things. Like, I mean, substance abuse and addiction, even just anything, like mm-hmm. Any vice that you have. I don't necessarily know that you have to just pinpoint it to puberty.
Well, so The Exorcist came out in the early 70s, and second wave feminism was alive and well. And counterculture was still a big part of America. And we see this movie where this like young child is like, she does, she like says and behaves in a way that is like inappropriate for like a child. So it definitely could you can see like these parental concerns being like portrayed in movies, right? So then people who have those concerns are interested in seeing the movie, right?
Yeah.
Right. So, right. But the reason that they like to go see the movies is because typically at the end of the movie, everything is fine, right? And yeah. So in a sense, it's reassuring that like, oh no, it's going to be okay. Like, things seem weird now, but it'll be all right. He also talks about how like a lot of the films like take like a daddy-daughter kind of theme as well. So it was just interesting, like the way, and I totally can see it, like how possession portrays like a parent's like biggest, you know, nightmare, that like their kid is behaving in an unexplainable way that they can't fix themselves. But in the movie, they get help and everything's fine at the end. And they go back to normal and they're not, you know, this weird person that uses words I don't understand and makes crude jokes and things like that. They go back to normal, innocent little kid. So
that's an interesting take. It's definitely one that I've never considered. I don't think I would have ever drawn that conclusion, like that psychiatrist did. That's really, it's interesting. It's an interesting take on it, and I mean, I can see where they're coming from, but I still think it's a stretch.
Okay, so like, let's move into specific movies then, shall we?
Sure.
So, like I said earlier, I had like two different sets of movies that I wanted to talk about, and I kept going back and forth because I really like to talk about movies that are easy to access for most people, so that if we talk about a movie that you're interested in, you can just like finish up the podcast and go stream it, and it's like no big deal. But some of the movies I really wanted to talk about were not available for free. And so I really wrestled with this. And so I ended up watching 5 movies to talk about today.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, when it comes to exorcisms and possession, there's no shortage. You're right. Like, and there's so many.
There are several movies that I was like, well, I feel like this movie would be better off reserved for a different topic, like the movie I mentioned that was about like a Dybbuk, or like The Taking of Deborah Logan. Those movies would be good for a different topic, or this topic, but so I reserved them.
Sure.
So the first two movies I'm going to talk about, these movies are available on Netflix. I'm going to talk about The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2. I'm not going to talk super in depth about these movies because I feel that Ed and Lorraine Warren deserve at least one dedicated episode.
They absolutely
have done so much stuff, and there's so much to talk about from so many different angles, but these two movies are about cases of possession. So I think that it's interesting to note, well, first of all, in case a listener isn't aware, Ed and Lorraine Warren were real people, and the Conjuring and Annabelle movies are about their true life case files, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, the movies are about things that they actually, they're based on cases that they actually attended to. Yeah. So, you know, as you're watching them, keep in mind, you know, that these are really actually based on true story things. Now, how much of a supernatural or paranormal true story is a real story, you know, nobody can prove at all.
Yeah. And, you know, the filmmakers take some liberties.
They do.
For absolutely. The purpose of, you know, jaw-dropping cinema.
Yeah. So, in the first movie, the couple attends to the, I think it's the Perrin family. It's a very classic story. They move into a house. Turns out house is probably haunted. And so the family is looking for help, and they find help in this couple, Ed and Lorraine Warren. They're paranormal investigators, and Ed Warren considers himself to be a demonologist. A reason that I think that this movie is very good to talk about for this episode is that in several scenes, Ed is actually teaching a course, apparently in demonology or something related. And he discusses the stages of possession, which in the movie he identifies as infestation, oppression, and possession. However, he actually noted it as more of like, I think, like a 5-stage thing. So I have a quote. Possession is the 4th stage of demonic activity. First comes encroachment, which is when the negative spirit is given an opening to a human being, even through voluntary means such as a satanic ritual, or involuntary means such as a curse or the performance of an unholy act. The second stage is infestation, when demons haunt a person's house. The third is oppression, when the spirits begin trying to take over the person living in the house. And then the 4th stage is possession. And then the 5th and final stage is death. Mm. So his belief set is that if it gets to the point of possession and no one intervenes, that person will die.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the motivation of Ed and Lorraine Warren, and in the movies, that's, you know, why they intervene in the ways that they do. So in the first movie, there's a spirit in the house, and actually there's multiple spirits in the house, and there may have been like this witch that lived on the land and blah blah blah. So in that film, an adult ends up getting possessed, and an exorcism takes place, and everything, spoiler alert, ends up just fine. So, and then in The Conjuring 2, the Warrens attend to the Enfield poltergeist case, which is a fascinating case that definitely could take up, you know, an entire hour of discussion. Mm-hmm. So this is a case that happens in England, and it's a case of poltergeist activity, and like most poltergeist activity, it mostly surrounds around like a early adolescent child in their household. So this one, there also ends up being a need for an exorcism. Everything ends up fine. However, The Conjuring 2, it's a little bit more clear that there's like a thread building between all of these movies, which people who are fans of the universe that has been built around these movies will know what I'm talking about. But there definitely is starting to be building this like a theatrical theme that will continue on through all the movies. So yeah, I think that these movies are very good. The first movie is definitely more like startling, like kind of like jump scary than the second movie, but they're definitely both worth watching. I would give them a 4 and then a 3 out of 5. Mm-hmm. And they're on Netflix right now, which means that they're free to watch if you have a subscription. So check those out if you haven't. The Conjuring universe also includes The Nun, the Annabelle movies, and the La Llorona movie that just came out a few years ago.
Does it technically also include Amityville, just because Ed and Lorraine Warren were also involved in that?
It does not in the sense of like a theatrical universe. I would say that because Amityville was a case that Ed and Lorraine did work in, it's connected, and there is a scene in The Conjuring 2 that addresses Amityville. However, a movie about Amityville has not been made that's part of like this collective, you know, like there are some characters that appear in the movie, like in different movies and stuff. So as a theatrical universe, no, but in real life, yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So, but yeah, they did work on Amityville. They worked on so many cases for like that kind of like late mid-century era that I feel like when you're talking about true paranormal cases, their names just keep coming up. It's kind of similar to if we're talking about more in like the spiritualism era, how like Harry Houdini and what's his face, the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, like their names just keep coming up for that era as well. Mm-hmm. So okay. So moving on to the movies that I wanted to cover, but was hesitant because I had to pay for each of these movies. Not a crazy amount. And actually the first one that I'm going to talk about is like sort of free. Anyways, so these three movies are not typical possession and exorcism movies, which I think makes them notable. The first is The Cleansing Hour. So The Cleansing Hour came out in 2019. It's an adaptation of a short film that came out in 2016. And it is available through the Shudder streaming service. So if you already have Shudder, it will be free to you. If you do not, you may be able to get a free trial. I subscribe to Shudder through my Amazon Prime account. So The Cleansing Hour follows the course of a night at the recording studio where an online exorcism show films. So the concept of the show is that this priest performs an exorcism, like live streams an exorcism, and he like sells merch and people donate money and stuff. But it becomes very apparent very early on in the movie that the priest guy is the whole setup is a fraud. They're just making money, and it's actors and actresses as like the people who need to have an exorcism. But shit gets pretty crazy because the person that they end up trying to perform the exorcism on becomes possessed.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah. So this one I feel like was a sneaky success. I really didn't know what to expect going into it, and it was pretty good. And I watched it again, and it was still pretty good. Like, a solid, like, 3.5 out of 5 stars. I didn't recognize any of the actors, which is pretty true for a lot of stuff on Shudder. But, like, it had, like, a couple jump scares. It had a very well thought out, like, mythology about it. It was definitely good. Definitely, definitely good. And I really liked that it didn't take a typical, like, trajectory of an exorcism movie. And in the end, it doesn't, everything doesn't turn out all right.
So that'll definitely make people good. Uncomfortable.
Yeah. It was definitely good. And, like, the actual ending, even though, like, the whole movie, I was like, okay, all right. Like, this, okay, all right. The actual ending, I was like, wait a minute.
Hey. You did What's going on here?
You did a trick on me.
You pulled a fast one, see?
It wasn't like a twist ending. It just was, you know, it wasn't expected. Definitely good. Yeah. I recommend it. Oh, what the fuck? All of my candles keep going out.
Uh-oh. It's encroachment.
Fuck. I don't even know what to do about that candle because it's like tunneling, which means that if I fix the tunneling, there's no way it's going to burn if it's putting itself out.
Yeah.
This candle doesn't smell good. That candle's done. Damn it. Okay, so the next is The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Did you see this? It came out in 2005.
And that's when I watched it. It's been a long time.
So this movie stars my brain just was like, "Nana."
We're going to hide that information from you.
This movie stars, I think her name's Jennifer Carpenter. She plays Emily Rose, and she might look familiar to many viewers. She's been in a lot of things. For me, the reason she looks familiar to me is because she played the reporter in the movie Quarantine, which is the English adaptation of the Spanish film Wreck. Yeah, so I think she's wonderful. Anyways, so she stars in this film, and it's a very interesting kind of exorcism movie. It's loosely based on the true story of Annalise Michael. So in real life, Annalise Michael had an exorcism and died.
Mm-hmm.
And her parents and the priests were held responsible. So the parents were excused because they had The parents were excused because they had gone through a lot already, and the priests were convicted of negligent manslaughter in the real life case.
Yikes.
Yeah. So the film follows the defense lawyer who is defending the priest that performs the exorcism. So it goes through the court case. And so the actual scenes of Emily Rose and, like, her progression of either illness or possession, and then the exorcism, those scenes are told, like, kind of in flashbacks during different people's testimony during the court case. So it looks at whether she had developed something that they refer to as epileptic psychosis, or if she was possessed. So it was definitely a very interesting way to tell the story as like a court procedural and an exorcism film.
Yeah.
I think that this is a really good movie. It has some scary parts, but it's not terrifying by any means. I took a bunch of notes while I was watching it. Let me see if there was anything worth sharing. Probably not. So yeah, This movie, I would say overall, is like a solid, like 4 out of 5 stars. It doesn't, you know, obviously, because it's a court case about her death, everything doesn't end up fine at the end. So, but yeah, it is really good. And it does a good job. You know, it presents these things in a way that it's not definitive. Like, the movie is, like, obviously, like, it follows the defense of the priest. So it seems favorable toward the priest and toward the theory that she was possessed. But it never, like, you know, it never, like, makes it so that there's no chance that maybe she was just sick.
Yeah.
You know, it tells it in a very balanced way. So, yeah, good movie. The last movie that I want to talk about is The Last Exorcism. Did you see this one?
I'm pulling it up now. It sounds familiar, but I don't think I've actually seen it. I think I've just heard of it in passing.
Okay. So this is a 2010 movie, and it's a found footage film, which people know I love found footage, even though it's not cool anymore. So it follows a pastor. So this is kind of a little diversion, right? We're not talking about a Catholic priest. This is an evangelical minister. And he basically has decided that he wants a documentary to be made because he has been performing fraudulent exorcisms, and he basically wants to do like an expose about himself, right? So the concept of the movie that he wants to be made is that he, you know, he was like raised in the church, he became a preacher, he learned how to like talk to people and manipulate them emotionally, and he feels that performing exorcisms helps people emotionally. And if you can do it in a way that helps the person find closure, it like empowers them to then make the changes that they need to make to get better.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that, I think that kind of speaks to what I was hitting on earlier, like, is something psychosomatic? Like, if you believe something enough, then it's real in its consequences to you. So then, like, if you go through, you know, what you believe will help you, then like chances are your brain's going to believe this is helping me.
Right. And so during the exorcisms, like he, through the film crew, he reveals like the tricks that he uses to like convince people of the process so that the people involved are convinced that this is all real. So he gets called. He gets called to perform an exorcism. And so he takes the film crew with him, and everything seems to be unfolding just fine, right? Until after they've performed the fake ritual and they get to their hotel room, and in the middle of the night, the girl that they exorcised shows up in the pastor's hotel room in like a trance. And then they're like trying to like get her to like get with it, get a little bit more lucid. And she like starts to behave like very provocatively. And it just becomes what seems like maybe a real story of possession. So then it goes in that trajectory for a while. And then it kind of changes a little bit. And then the ending is kind of like, wait a minute. So this one, I really like this movie. I would give it like 4 out of 5 stars. I found out while I was doing research for what to watch for this episode that there's a sequel. I didn't watch it because it didn't seem like it would fit with the theme as closely, but this movie definitely, it really has you thinking. And when I watched it for this episode, I watched it with a friend of mine who hadn't seen it before. And the whole time she was like, wait a minute, That is, wait a minute. So I really feel like it's definitely worth the watch.
Yeah.
And then these last couple movies, I think one of them I was able to watch for free by getting a 2-week trial to like a premium channel on Amazon or maybe on my HBO Max. And the other one I paid like $3 for or something. I don't know. You can find them if you look. They're online, but
yeah.
Yeah. So those are the movies that I watched and I would recommend them all.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen The Conjuring, but the other three that you highlight, I know I've seen Exorcism of Emily Rose, though it's been years. I should go back and watch it. The other two, The Last Exorcism and what was that other, the first one?
The Cleansing Hour.
Those sound really interesting. I want to watch it. And what I like about all of this is that while they're all on the topic of possession and or exorcism, even within each of these movies, there's kind of a different plot. Like even with The Exorcism of Emily Rose, based on a true story, presented from kind of like a legal standpoint, like exorcism was performed, person died, and then you see the argument on both sides.
Right.
Is possession real? Was the patient just, you know, suffering from or living with this mental illness? The others are kind of like based, you know, I know at least The Conjuring, I know based on true stories, that's really just kind of presenting the story itself. It's like, there's all just different kinds of, I mean, even within, I guess, like possession, you can see the different like viewpoints come out in the different movies. And it makes you think, which is really kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. They were definitely all very interesting ways to tell the story of a possession. Yeah. So, I have a story to tell you if we want to get through the thank yous and announcements quickly.
Sure.
Okay. So, we're still planning on doing our gift exchange. It hasn't happened because of my personal life being a mess. So I don't know. It'll happen eventually.
No rush.
No rush. Thank you to Necropodicon for being our home on the internet. Thank you to Dr. Evil for our theme music. Thank you to our patrons for their support on Patreon. If you would like to support the show, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/shivers. Follow our social media. We're at Shivers Podcast on everything. You can send us an email, shiverspodcast@gmail.com. If you have any comments or ideas, a short story to share, send that over to us. Leave us a review on iTunes or whatever service it is that you use to listen to us. It really helps a lot. I think that's it.
I think so.
And remember, it's always Shivers with 2 V's.
2 V's.
Okay. So let me get over here to this document. So this is an original story that I wrote.
Ooh.
All right. Are you ready? It's pretty spooky over here.
I'm ready.
Okay. Voices, paranoia, disorganized thoughts, lack of emotional engagement. These are the signs of schizophrenia that are noted on my intake paperwork at Hillside. The admitting doctor, Sally Schufert, was fairly easy to sway. It only took a couple days of watching YouTube videos and reading articles to be confident that I could fake a serious diagnosis well enough to be admitted here. Hillside specializes in what they call psychological rehabilitation of adolescents and young adults, seemingly a revolving door of admissions and discharges, churning out docile young men and women. Unlike similar facilities in the past, the folks who leave here are not emotionless drones drugged or treated to be dull. Far from it. They're upstanding citizens. But what I cannot figure out is how they so consistently become active in the church. And not just any church, no. This trendy new church just outside of town, New Day. I think that this so-called hospital is a weird religious pipeline, and I want to know what kind of brainwashing they're using to get so many young people to turn to the church and why. probably a classic cult scheme to get money and adoration. Dr. Schufert had left me in the interview room while a nurse came in to do a quick assessment and talk to me about the rules and routines in the hospital. Once we were in my private room, she left me to change into the standard issue sweatsuit and an expectation that I would be in attendance for group therapy before dinner. According to my research, I'm expecting a combination of cognitive behavioral therapy and medication to help manage the symptoms of my disorder. According to my observations of the folks who have been treated here, I have no idea if that's what I'm going to get. The group session is art therapy with only minimal instruction. We're simply encouraged to illustrate what makes us happy through collage. There are magazines and old calendars all over the oversized table, and me and six other patients quickly get to quiet work looking for appropriate pictures. Looking around, it seems like the youngest person here is a girl, probably around 15 years old. No one here looks old enough to drink, and add to that the lack of makeup and navy sweats, and the group all looks very similar. Everyone stays fairly quiet, the room mostly filled with the sounds of shuffling paper, scissors, and the sticky slap of glue sticks. I'm mostly looking for pictures of animals while trying to focus on my mental illness act. I notice that the other collages are fairly typical. Several people have found religious images for their work. After almost an hour, the leader tells us it's time to wrap up, and everyone shifts seamlessly into cleaning up. Once the room is cleaned, the group stands around the table and starts praying as a group. It's not the Lord's Prayer that I know, but they recite it so well, as if they've all known it their whole lives. At dinner, I'm less surprised to see them all recite grace together. After dinner, we have group again, this time to discuss how to deal with stress. I'm surprised that the leader of this group, the nurse from earlier, is recommending prayer as a realistic strategy to cope with stressful situations. Turn to the Lord in prayer. Don't worry, be steadfast in prayer. Not current evidence-based behavior modification. We close the session in prayer and are instructed to go to our rooms to get ready for bed. After a while, I start to hear the hushed whispers of the others in the same hall as me, and it doesn't take long to figure out that they're all praying. I'm looking forward to meeting the treating physician in the morning, Dr. Jacob Masterson. As I was told, I'm called away from the larger group after breakfast and taken to an office in another area of the facility. Dr. Masterson is tall, handsome, and appears to be in his 40s. He has a gentle tone to his voice, and he explains to me that my treatment plan involves an anticipated week of inpatient treatment with a total of 3 therapeutic sessions to help heal me of my affliction and prepare me for outpatient management. He uses modern language to refer to the plan, but the details seem off. The day drags on similar to the last, and a small part of each session seems consistent with evidence-based practice, but the large part is religious affirmation. Everyone seems to be in total agreement with the message, and no one seems skeptical of the likelihood that these recommendations are the way to better mental health. A couple people go home by the end of the second day, and during dinner, I ask around a little and find that everyone in my group is going home in the next couple days. And they've all had at least 2 of these therapeutic sessions, which just seems to confirm my suspicion of brainwashing or electroshock therapy. I'm starting to waver in my commitment of discovering the truth. How am I supposed to accomplish this anyways? Some gap year brat trying to expose a medical professional. I'm nervous about the potential for electroshock, and I'm unsure if I can refuse the treatment. The anxiety is helping to sell my performance as a schizophrenic, however. The next evening, I get pulled away from my first session. I'm taken to a large, dark room in the basement, and I feel relieved when I'm not met with the strapped table from my One Flew Over the Cuckoo Nest nightmares. Dr. Masterson is waiting for me in the room and gestures for me to sit on the large couch. He pulls a chair up in front of me and holds my hands in his. "Let's pray together, Suzanne." He has bowed his head, so I follow his example, wary of what we are going to do next. Heavenly Father, we call upon you today to rid this girl of her demons. May she find peace through you. I'm about to speak in anticipation of an amen when he drops my hands and stands up. He walks to a small table and picks up a Bible and a cross. I notice that there are two other books, as well as a small glass vial remaining there. He starts speaking again in a language I don't recognize. I put together fairly quickly that this is some kind of exorcism. Not exactly what I was expecting, but better than what I had feared. I sit quietly and patiently wait for him to finish, all in all, fairly innocuous. Could the big secret really be that this guy just convinces folks of a religious intervention? That might explain the church-going discharges. Two nights later, I'm called for another session and find much of the same. The ritual seems longer, and I doze off a bit. I wake up on the floor, and then the doctor is gone and the lights are off, but just outside I can hear people talking. After I make a little noise, they come in to help get me to bed. I fall asleep so easily, and I sleep so well. Two nights later, at my last session, the doctor suggests that I start laying down. While I anticipate more of the same this time, I feel very uneasy. My stomach gets upset, and I start to vomit in the middle of the whole routine. I get weak, and I can't get up from the couch when I want to leave. I want to leave. Is this the brainwashing? What happened last time? I can't really remember. What did I do earlier today? Am I already brainwashed? Someone else has come into the room. Who is that? I haven't seen him here before. He's taller than the doctor, but I can't see him well. It's so dark in here. He comes to me and places his hand on my face, my sweat dripping into my eyes. He looks right at me and says to me, "My child, you shall find peace." When I wake up, I'm at the dining table with my new group. I don't really remember anyone here. Before I can say anything, though, I'm starting to feel tired again. In the morning, Dr. Masterson is sitting in my room with me. I'm sitting on the edge of my bed, and he is in a chair he brought in. I don't remember him coming in. He smiles at me. "You seem to have found peace, Suzanne. You'll be going home today." I don't really feel peaceful. I'm afraid and confused. What am I supposed to do now? I feel anxious and paranoid, out of touch with what's really happening. I'm walking into church, new day. I see the other people from my group here, as well as some other people I knew had gone to Hillside. I don't remember how I got here. Did I drive? Did I come with someone? As I pass through the doors, I can hear groups of people chatting, but I can't understand them. What language is that? It sounds familiar, but I can't place it. A group of people turn to me and smile. It feels wrong. They seem to know me, but I don't know them. Do I? Suzanne, I received a message from your outpatient program that you need another session. Dr. Masterson is in my living room. Did I let him in? I don't think I need another session. I feel fine. The last bit is a lie. I feel far from fine. What day is it? I see someone moving at the edge of the room. It's the tall man from before. The lights flicker as he walks towards me. My child, do not be afraid. The end.
Ew, he's creepy. I don't like that. How do you get in there?
Well, Candy.
Yes.
That's all.
That is. That's all, folks.
Well, hopefully things will go as planned and we'll be able to get together in a couple weeks.
Heck yeah.
Okay. We'll see you guys then. Bye. Bye.
Hey, it's your best friend Danny here. If you enjoy art, literature, or the creative process, you may enjoy the comedy podcast Grow Out of It. You may even learn something about your long-lost childhood self. Or you might just get something like this. Mason and I hadn't really talked much. Besides our first encounter and the occasional, "Help me stand up!" we hadn't had a need to raise the Necropodicon. Hard to pronounce?